I'm Carol Peterson, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to the local history and unique culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys. I'm filling in for Kristen Marchand today, but not to worry. She's still here, along with Leslie Betts and Kathy Chepesky, all members of the Opiongo Readers Theater. All are here with a show about three amazing women who once graced our streets here in Barry's Bay. Helen Dombrowski, Teresa Beanish, and Mary Cebulski. All gone now, but certainly not forgotten, thanks to the many significant things they helped build for the rest of us. A few years ago, we brought you a similar show. It was called Lilies of the Valley, and it had a decidedly feminine point of view. We know there is no shortage of stories from our local history that deal with our founding fathers and other significant men who have made us what we are today. But it's part of our raison d'etre to remind everybody that man does not live on bread alone, or, well, put another way, behind every great man, you catch our drift. So, let's get on with our show. First up is the story of a remarkable woman, Helen Lorbetsky, who was born in 1912 and passed away 100 years later in 2012. She started off her life wanting to be a nun, but ended up marrying Peter Dombrowski. And, as the story goes, she helped deliver 146 babies in her own home during the 1950s. Before our local hospital was built. But let's let Helen tell you all about that. Here's Kristen Marchand reading Helen's own words, taken from a transcribed interview with her, prepared in 1991.
My father was a great farmer. There were 15 in our family. We were all good workers. He made sure that we worked hard and that the land was worked well. He bought one farm after the other. My father was a great worker and a good manager. He really loved the farm. He liked the farmland maybe more than the younger children. The children didn't care too much because most of our time was spent working. My father's name was Jacob. He didn't like the name Jacob. He wanted to be called James. He was married to Victoria Rakuski, and there were 9 sisters and 6 brothers. The oldest one was Frank, then was Annie, then was Tom, Peter, Katie, Frances, Genevieve, Rose, Emily, John, Albert, and myself, Helen. Apollonia was the one that was burnt when we had a fire on the farm. And then there was Dominic and Margaret. The fire is almost my first memory. I was 5 or 6 years old. This was in May. My sisters and my mother were out shearing sheep on the ground. I was with them. Apollonia was in the barn, and she was shaking her head at me to go. She wanted to go where the men were, out in the field sowing grain. I shook my head no. I was more interested in the sheep than going out to the men. She went to the house. We never found out whether she made the fire or just what, but when we turned around, the sisters and my mother, they noticed smoke coming from the house. My mother ran to the house. She tried to put the fire out, but when she threw water on the fire, it only spread all the more. And then the sisters ran to help her put out the fire, but they couldn't do anything about it. It was really going. They were looking for my young sister. They thought maybe she was outside, but she wasn't outside. My mother called for Apollonia. Then she realized that she must have been in the house. My mother jumped into the flames, just forgetting everything except that the child was in the house. She ran into the flames, but we had good German neighbors, the Kiels, and they pulled my mother out because she would have burned. Some of her burns were third degree, the doctor said, and she was in serious condition. But the good neighbors took her over to the house and they took care of my mother. Can you imagine that? That she was willing to die to save the daughter? The love of a mother for her child, even though she had 15 children. Can you imagine? I got very lonesome because they were saying that they didn't know whether my mother was going to live. She was going to perhaps not survive. And we knew that my sister was dead. There was nothing else but bones. I wanted to see that child so much that I looked for any sign, But of course they got the bones and the carcass, and they buried it. Anyway, my mother survived, and we all came home, and nobody talked too much about what had happened. Just a new start. We went to school at the Haggerty School. We had to walk about 3 miles, winter or summer. In the wintertime, we had to walk over the drifts. We were on our hands and knees to get to that school sometimes, because there would be a lot of drifts over the hills. Those country schools were very cold. Your feet were really freezing when you went there. The teacher would have about 30 or 35 pupils of all different grades. Myself, I was sort of an orphan. I lived in so many different places. Whenever my sister or my brother had a baby, my mother would send me out to help, so I'd lose a lot of schooling, and I wanted to learn so much. I was everybody's helper. And I guess I had a way with children. I don't know how many different places I went. It really interfered with my schooling. When the babies were good, I'd be at school. When there was work, then I'd be home. I used to find it very difficult to catch up with the others. I don't know if I minded. You never questioned those things. You just did what you were told to do. We were always told that as kids. You do what you're told to do. We never questioned that. Never. There was no other way. I never even used to give it a thought. Maybe sometimes it was lonesome too, but I don't even remember that too much. But in some cases, I was not treated very well, you know. Because I was a little girl, I couldn't do the jobs with the heavy lifting and that, and I'd get punished for it, like skip a meal or something. Not all of the places were like that, but one place was, and my father and mother, they never checked into it. Maybe they knew about it. That's the way it was in life before. You never questioned, you just obeyed and did, because it was hard everywhere, no matter where you were. I wasn't the only one. My sister Rose would be away a lot of times. I remember one time when she was coming home, I said, "Mother, look, there's Rosie Shala coming." And my mother was kind of hurt. She said, "That's not Rosie Shala. That's our Rosie." Kids used to go and help other people. We found it very hard. We used to be very tired. But anyway, I grew up, and I had different ideas from the others. Maybe they had ideas too, but I made the move. Because at the age of 15, I read a Sacred Heart Messenger magazine, and it gave me an idea. There were no movies, no radio, no TV then. All you did was go to church, to school, or work. I wanted to see some of what the other side of the world looked like. So in the Sacred Heart Messenger magazine, I read about Sisters of St. Joseph. That's all I knew about Sisters of St. Joseph. I didn't tell my mother and father. I was kind of scared to say anything. I did things on my own, you know. Then I found that the Sisters of St. Joseph were in Killaloe. My sister Emily was working in Killaloe, and I phoned her. I said, "In the convent in Killaloe, there are Sisters of St. Joseph. Something is urging me to talk to them. I might consider a convent life." And I asked her if she would take me to the convent to talk to the sisters. We went to see the sisters, and I brought the subject up that I was thinking of becoming a sister. They said, "Oh, you're just at a good time. Mother Juliana, the Reverend Mother, is coming next week. Come again and talk to her." So that's what I did. When I came to her, she said, "You're very young," she said. 15 is very young. When's your birthday?" I said, "May 14th. She said, "I'll suggest something to you. The entering day is in July. I'll suggest that you come to school for a few months and enter in July." So, okay, I agreed. Was I ever brave? I made all the arrangements before I told my parents. Then I went to milk with my mother in the early morning. It was cold in the stable. We had many cows to milk. Mother was milking cow and I was at the other. I was pulling. I said, "Mother." She said, "Yes." I said, "Mother, I'm going to the convent." She said, "Yes?" I said, "Yes." Then she said, "Well, when will that be?" I said, "I'm supposed to go to Killaloe to school. The entering is in July." So that was settled. I wasn't going to tell my father because I was scared to tell him. I left it to my mother to talk to him. My father didn't know what to think of it. I was thinking about it the other day. How bold I was. My father always said I was different. Well, I guess I was different. But there was one thing he said. Children, when you make up your mind, make up your mind. No fooling about it. So that is what I did. I went to school, and then in July, then I took off to Pembroke by train, and the Sisters of St. Joseph met us at the train. They met us at the station in Pembroke. There were 18 of us, so I wasn't lonesome one bit. I was fascinated by everything. I stayed there and made my vows after a year's time, and every year I repeated them. I stayed there for 3 solid years without going home. They were strict at that time. I had ambition there because I could do it. Well, they put me in charge of the laundry, baking altar breads, and they took me to help to decorate the churches and chapels. I enjoyed doing things, you know. I had no problem. I picked things up fast, but I found them very interesting. Then after the 3 years, I didn't know whether it was the right thing for me to do. So I came home. They were upset at home. They had been happy I was in the convent. I guess they were a little proud. They didn't say so, but I thought they were. And then I came home and everybody was disappointed. But, well, they'd say, that's not your vocation. And with all the girls that went after that, I wondered what it was about them. They stuck and stayed there and were happy. What was the matter with me? But when I stayed in the world, I didn't want to go back. That was where I was supposed to be. In the world. God had other plans. 2 years after I left the convent, my brother and my sister, they were chumming around with some friends and they found this guy. They told him of me. I guess they were trying to match, eh? And I wasn't ready for that yet. I didn't want to jump into that until I was about 25 years old, at least. That's what I was counting on, 25 years old. Then I'll think about it, but not now. I was put out with them that they'd always bring this guy along. I'd be in bed. They'd throw stones at the window to get my attention. I would say, go ahead, do whatever you like. I'm not going. And then finally, sometimes you get intrigued, you know? And soon it became kind of serious. This guy, Peter Dombrowski, he was such a good-natured guy. It's funny how you sort of get into those things. 2 years after I left the convent, I married Peter. We married May 16th, 1933. And my people were saying, well, he hasn't got a thing. My father was like that. We girls were supposed to marry farmers with a farm and buildings. My father helped his sons with farms. Every one of them had a farm. So when his daughters get married, well, these men were supposed to have farms. And Peter didn't. So it was kind of a disappointment to them. Peter's people were on a farm, yes, but they wanted to enjoy themselves more. They were not just the serious workers, you know. They wanted to have fun, too. And I wanted that, too. I wanted to work, but I wanted a little bit of laughter, too, in my life. And Peter would take me to dances or to weddings. We really enjoyed ourselves dancing. There wasn't much joking at home for me. We were very serious all the time. Everything was serious. And I wanted a little bit of the other way around. I liked to get out and have a little bit of fun. It was hard. It was tough. But I said to my parents, I have 2 hands and I have 2 feet. Even if I have a little bit of land, I'm going to cultivate it. If nothing else, I'll grow enough to make some soup. I think that I really put a lot of question marks into my parents' minds. They were not really that much put out. They just wondered, what in the world is this girl going to do next? We moved to Barry's Bay and we stayed here for 7 years. The baby started coming. We rented for a little while, and then Peter bought a little lot. On the lot, there were pine trees. He got them sawed into lumber, and we built a little house for ourselves. So we had a house, and it was a kind of a nice little house. But then Peter went to an auction sale in Hopefield. He left me at home painting the house, finishing it up. I was so happy because the house was beginning to look real nice. I had it nearly finished painting when he came home. He said, Helen, hurry up. Pack up. I bought a farm. This was in May. I didn't say anything. I didn't say I don't want to go. I didn't raise any roof. Okay, you bought a farm, so we're going to move. Deep down, I thought, my son is going to school in Barry's Bay, and it's a good school. Now what? He's not going to get the education I had in my heart for him. In a week's time, we were on the farm. A week's time, because we had to hurry. This was May, and we wanted to plow our gardens. We wanted to plant a garden, so we packed up our dressers and everything. We loaded them all in the wagons, and off we went to Hopefield. Oh, that May time, and the flies were terrible, and the house was terrible. Everything was run down. If people saw that now, they'd run. But I was game. I'm going to clean up this house, we're going to fix it, and we're going to get that garden in. We have lots of land here. Everything was run down. The roofs were falling down. You opened the door in the house and you couldn't close it. And the floors. Scrubbing with a brush where there were big knots in the floor, and you're scrubbing and you hit your knuckles. Dirty. There were bed bugs all over the whole place. The children were so upset, they cried. Out of our nice house, we come here. I said, I'm going to fix it up. I'm going to clean it up while you're in school. When you come back, it's going to be all cleaned up. That cheered them. And then they found that it was pretty good on the farm because they could run around the fields. We really worked. Peter would go to the bush. We cut logs, so we had to get horses. We only had an old wagon that we fixed up. Sometimes the wagon would fall apart out in the field. I said, it will do for this year. Maybe next year we can buy a better one. And we got a few sheep and a cow, and we had the horses. My people said, you're going to starve, you know. You're going to starve. I said, no, I won't. I'm not going to starve. I have my two hands and two feet. I built a garden, and everything was really growing. That fall, the turnips were so nice and big that Peter used to take them out to the camps and sell them. So every little bit helped on our way. Sure, we were poor. But we were looking ahead. Better times are coming. Better times are coming. People liked Peter because he was full of fun. He was good with the children. I would be tired and he would come home tired from the bush. But still, we would play with the children. We played a hiding game. One of us would hide one of the kids. We might hide them under the washstand and the others were supposed to look. One time, he put one of the kids in the coveralls that were hanging on the wall, hanging on the nail. Everybody laughed. The kids loved their dad. We had to work in the bush to pay off what we owed on the farm. And of course, we wanted to raise animals. My father gave us three older sheep. I said, that's good, Peter. They're going to have lambs. That's a start. And then we got one pig. And then I said, that's good. She's going to have some little pigs. And cows. We had a few cows. Well, they're going to have calves. That's how we worked it. My husband was afraid we would never make it. He was the worrier. I was the one that was always on the go. I would encourage him. He worked hard in the bush, and while he was in the bush, I'd milk the cows, clean out the stables, and look after the things at home, the meals and the children. After 16 years, we were able to buy a second-hand car and put a little bit of money in the bank. By now, I had six children. We were happy, and then our house burned down. One morning, Peter made the fire and the kids were getting ready to go to school. One of the kids ran upstairs for something and they came down and they said, there's a fire upstairs. We tried to put it out, but it was too far gone. So it burned. It was very cold. It was the 20th of January and the wind was very cold. We stuck the kids under the hay in the horse stable. We had to keep watching the fire because of the wind. We didn't know whether the stables were going to go too. I was in shock for a little while. I couldn't move because I thought we had everything just right. But we were going to make it again, you know. We'll make it. And sure enough, in the fall, it was beautiful. You would go up in the hills and see the trees in color all around you. When I went to do the chores, I would just stand and look around at the beauty of the hills. But the farm wasn't much. The kids were leaving. We were kind of isolated. We had no phone, the roads were bad, and sometimes you'd have to get up and push the car. We had no lights. So I said to Peter, do you know what? I said, The kids are leaving and the neighbors are old. I don't think I want to stay here. I was kind of pushing to go back to town. And Peter went along. So then we started building this house here. And then you know what happened? At haying time, one of the sons jumped off of a fence onto a scythe. He bashed his big toe. Peter brought him to Dr. Dooley here in Barry's Bay. And Peter was talking to Dr. Dooley and he said, "My wife has a notion to come and build a house in Barry's Bay." There was no hospital at that time and the doctors had to go in the country to deliver babies. So Dr. Dooley said, "Well, if you ever build a house big enough," he said. "Maybe I could bring my mother's in." And Peter said, "My wife wanted to go and work. I think she'll go for it." Peter had such a confidence in me that sometimes he put me into things I really didn't want. So Peter came back to the farm and he said, "Helen, I have a job for you." And I said, "With who? And what?" He said, "This is what Dr. Dooley told me." And he told me, and I said, "I don't think so. I don't think I could stand deliveries. I often thought that that's a job I wouldn't want." I said, "I don't think that I would like that." I said, "Maybe I couldn't get along with the doctor either." Peter said, "You're going to get along just fine." I said, "Okay." We moved into this house in Barry's Bay on September the 8th, 1955. And then there were 146 babies born here. The doctor used to come here to deliver the babies. He steered the ones that were difficult for the Pembroke Hospital. But when there was no difficulties, then he would steer them here. And I got right into it. I liked the people. I really did. I did it to help the people out. I didn't do it to gain money. I made a little, but not that much because there was no insurance and people were poor. So I did the cooking and the washing for the mothers and the babies. I had three at once sometimes. They would stay 5 days mostly. Sometimes one would stay longer. I was able to go there and hold their hands and, you know, be with them. And I would do their laundry, feed them, and clean everything up. But it was hard. It was day and night. I had no dryer and only a gas washer. And at first, Dr. Dooley used to have to help me get water from the pump. There would be three or four lines of laundry outside, and in the winter time, I'd hang the clothes up over the doors in the house to get them dry. But I found the work interesting. That's why I was able to manage. My husband was working at a mill all this time. I'd have meals prepared for him, and he'd have to come and eat by himself and go off. But he got me into it. He might as well put up with it now. This went on for 5 years until they built the hospital. Then I worked in the hospital for almost 9 years. And when I wasn't in the maternity section, I would look after the old people. I saw those elderly people lying in the hospital. I thought, "Oh my God, I'm going to be like that someday." And I thought, "Oh gee, they're wasting their lives. Can't something be done?" You could see they were depressed and lonely. When I quit working at the hospital, I did nothing for a little while. Well, I nearly climbed the walls because I still wanted people. I always did like people and wanted to be with people. I find them interesting. I don't think I could live without people. By now, Peter was getting his pension check. 1 month, there was a little slip with it that told you how to get the grant for senior citizens. I looked at it and ignored it. I thought, "No, don't get yourself in that, Helen." But I'd pull it out again and look at it, and then I thought, "Yeah, those people that you were looking at, the older people in the hospital, you go out and help them." And one day at a dinner, Chris Mullen, the reeve of Sherwood, Burns, and Jones, and a priest, Father O'Brien, were talking about what was available to the seniors. They said what was available and what could be done. It was left up to the seniors to see who was interested in doing something. So I was waiting. We were sitting around the tables. Nobody made a move. But some of the women started elbowing. "You do it, Helen, you do it." I said, "I'm not going to do it alone. I need help." I was kind of scared, but I thought, "Well, somebody's got to do it." So I said to one of the women, "Will you help me?" "Yeah, I will." "Okay." So we went up to the front and I said, "Here we are. What do you want us to do?" "Phone the seniors," he said. "If you can get 30 people interested in this, then call me." So I went to work right away calling the people. I got my 30 seniors. Yes, they were interested. Yes, they wanted that. So I phoned Father O'Brien and told him the situation. I said, you have your 30 people, now call a meeting. So that's what he did. And we got the ball rolling. And that was the start of the Opiongo Trailblazers. Well, now the new gang have a new club. We only had the old train station here, but we were happy because when we'd get together, it was just like a party at home. So now I'm taking it easy. I thank God for everything I learned. I think God knows what he's doing because I learned so much. I remember picking stones, Peter and me with the kids, for 11 days straight. We were so exhausted that we just sat, you know, and threw the stones in a big hole. And for what? We left the farm and now it's all grown over again. Sometimes you wonder, eh? And that's life. But if you did your best, you have no regrets. Because there's a better life after, a better life. I'm a widow, and in May I'll be 80 years old. It's time for me to stop and pray. I have had many, many favors answered. I looked after Peter at home almost to the end. Finally, he had to go to the hospital. He had a stroke with a high fever. He was so restless. I was going to the hospital every day to feed him, and I was so exhausted. I often prayed. I said, God, take him. God said, I will. I'll take him. We were there when he was dying. He had the oxygen and he had the intravenous running. After the stroke, he couldn't speak, so he had his eyes open and his mouth open. And I thought, now I can tell you what I want and what you want to hear. So I says, Peter, I said, you get out of this bed and come home. He closed his eyes and his mouth, and he said, yeah. And he was gone.
That was Kristen Marchand reading from the transcribed interview of Helen Dombrowski back in 1991. Next up is the story of Teresa Mask, who was born in 1917 and who remains one of the great ladies, if not a true force of nature, who helped mold the spirit of Barry's Bay into what it is today. And, like Helen Dombrowski, Teresa's life story was written in her very own words in 1991. It's read by Leslie Betts.
What is now known as Mask Island was registered as Welshman's Island in the district of Nipissing in 1873. It's recorded, mind you. And I've traced it from then right down to when my dad purchased it, and then it was taken over by my brother after dad passed away. There was Indians living on it before. Then on the 19th of March, 1873, the island was registered to an Edward Williams. He was a Welshman. That's why they called it Welshman's Island. It was recorded as 186 or 190 acres. Williams lived 10 years here from 1873 to 1883. Then he sold it to Arthur and Martha Acton in 1883. In 1893, they sold it to Robinson and Reeves. William Dunn and his wife Anne had it from 1893 to 1896. They weren't here too long. Then Francis Dunn was here from 1896 to 1909. And then John Billings was here from 1909 to 1913. Then Albert White bought it in 1913, and he sold it in November of 1917 to Paul B. Mask, my father. My father closed the deal on the day I was born, November the 24th, 1917. We moved on March 1918 when the ice was settled. My father didn't have much education, but he could figure things out. My mother was a school teacher in Round Lake, and that's where he met her. My mother taught school for several years before she was married, but after she was married, she raised a family and worked on the farm. Her home was up here at what they call Windy City up the Bernacchi Road. She was a Bernacchi. When she was going to school, she'd always say, "Oh, I'll never go on that island. That's water and I'm scared of it." She never thought she would live here on the island. Oh, she was very scared when my dad closed the deal on the island. My father owned a sash and door factory in Killaloe. He owned it before he was married and he lived there until 1917. But he was a farm boy and a country boy. So the doctor told him, "You better get out in the open air instead of being inside doing building." So he came here. He paid quite a bit at that time, too. A party came up to me and said, "Oh boy, my uncle could have bought this island for $500. I said, "Too bad he didn't buy it." I said, "Our dad didn't buy it for no $500. My father was quite an investor. When he saw a chance, he invested into property. The island was an investment. He'd say, "Go ahead, maybe that." And he was always successful in coming through it. I don't think he ever lost anything that he invested. There were hard times, but he always tried to keep it up. Maybe there wasn't all the money, but we always had enough to eat and enough to wear. Our family lived there all alone. Our mother used to tell us, "Our neighbor is the water." It was very scary. We lost a lot of school in our young days, in between getting settled and the ice and the water and the freeze-up. We went to school in a rowboat for several years until my dad built the first floating bridge. I guess it was built about 28 or 29. All through the 30s and the 40s, it was the floating bridge, up until 1952. Then the municipality of Sherwood, Jones and Burns took over and built a causeway. My father donated around $1,000 for fill. The bridge floated on logs. There were raised piers at each end. It was quite an experience. If anybody did drive, they had to drive with caution because it was nothing but logs on each side. No rails, nothing. Sometimes the floating bridge broke out and went out onto the lake. The big windstorms would come and rip it apart, and then we had to go in a rowboat to church. I can recall when my aunt's brother, Father Coolis, was being ordained in our church. His family brought him out from Pog Lake, and they asked if he could stay over at my mother's and dad's. So they tried to get him over the floating bridge in a little narrow car. They just went part way, and the wheels got stuck in the logs in the middle of the bridge. They had more fun over that, oh by golly. Everything that came to the island had to come on that floating bridge. Unless it was something big. If it was something big, we'd wait till winter when you could drive over the ice. Our dad had another ranch across the lake for his cattle. He would pasture them there in the summer months. They were taken there over the floating bridge, and many times some of the cattle fell in. It was quite an experience. All the family had to help. This whole island used to all be one big farm, and everything was done mostly by horses and by hand. Our dad had a first tractor in the 30s. We always helped at thrashing time. We had to work together on the farm. The three oldest children were born within 3 years, so you can imagine how close we were. When my mother took sick, we had to plow in and do the cooking and bake the bread and milk the cows. We would garden and go picking berries in the summer. No such thing as going uptown to get the bread. We used to raise a lot of potatoes. One time my dad had over 400 bags of potatoes, and he'd have a bee. A bunch of ladies would come over and Dad would have a kind of digger, and they'd go behind the digger picking them up and bagging them. It was something. Everyone worked very hard, but we enjoyed it. We were always told that the farm was good farmland, and my dad was a real hard-working farmer. When we were small, we'd say, "Oh, Dad, why are you working so hard?" And he'd say, "We have to work and not sell the farm," he'd say. "I just love it. I want to go to the grave here." Mother and Dad raised a large family, 6 girls and 3 boys, namely Evelyn, Florence, Teresa, Raymond, Leona, Clementine, Elmer, Sylvia, and Donald. Everyone was born at home. There were no hospitals then, sometimes no doctor. Dad was working with his hands when he passed away. It was in November. It was Friday the 13th, 1964, hunting season. He was just about 80 years old. He said to my mother, "I'm going to check the fence and see to the cattle, and tomorrow I'm going hunting." He had his license in his pocket. But after a while, my mother said, "Go and see how Grandpa is." And so one of the kitties come flying through, and he said, "Oh, Grandpa's lying on the ground between the stable and the house." He had a screwdriver and a hammer in his hand, and he was dead. It was a very great shock to my mother and all our sisters and brothers. He worked hard, my dad. He was in municipal affairs for 27 years. He liked to serve as a reeve. Today, they get paid for all their meetings and everything. In those days, they got $10 or $20 a year. He was a clever man. He'd stand on his feet, but he was not a man that would run anybody down. If he saw somebody was wrong, he'd tell them. He'd just say, look it, he'd say. I can't take that. Nobody is perfect. He was nominated twice to be the county warden, and he declined because he figured he didn't have the education. I have his obituary here from the Eganville Leader. Mr. Mask was a reeve for 18 years in Barry's Bay and Sherwood, Jones and Burns. He was on the council 27 years in all, maybe more, and he was nominated for the county warden twice, and he declined each time. Oh, and he was so good to the people as a reeve. If he saw people hungry, he'd get my mother and they would walk miles to take some food out there from the municipality. In the fall, if people were sick or didn't have work, my parents took them a bag of flour and a bag of sugar and salt and tea and coffee, the main things, and some meat unless they had their own pigs or cows. They would make sure that the people had to last the winter through. It was called relief in those days, and it was the only help. My mother was always right beside my father to help out. A lot of farmers went to the bush in the fall, and they didn't come out until spring. I can recall one winter my father wanted to work in the bush at the Bonnechere, and my mother said, I'll go with you to cook and let the bigger children here look after the farm for a few months. And we managed good. My dad spent many winters in his bush lot to cut logs and also wood for our wood stoves. We had no electricity, only coal oil lamps. We worked very hard with the church. We were always taught the church in our home was first. We went to church every Sunday. We had to go. We belonged to the choir and we worked for the church organization. We would sell tickets and work at the picnics. When we were small, we were taught that. The sisters taught us violin and piano music in school. It was classical. They'd never allow us to play old-time fiddle music. Well, I used to play the violin in an orchestra, and we used to go to Knights of Columbus doings. We used to go and play while they had their meetings, then have some entertainment. When it was time to go home, Monsignor Bernacchi would say, "You can't go home. It's too dark to cross the bridge with no lights." So I'd have to stay at the rectory. He'd let my mother know not to worry before I left. We'd look forward to a chance to stay at the rectory. We liked it very much. He was so kind to us. Monsignor Bernacchi was a founder of a lot of things in our parish, but he was also our uncle, my mother's brother. He used to come over to the farm and say, "I want some chickens. I'm going to have dinner for the altar boys or the church workers." Monsignor Bernacchi died penniless. If he had a few dollars, he gave it away. He got sick in June and he passed away the last day of the year, and the hospital was built the next year. He was the founder of our hospital. He had the charter, the land, and all the plans for it, but he didn't live to see it built. He was parish priest from 1910 to 1959. They didn't take him away as parish priest from the church until after his death. He was quite a guy, but he went at an early age. He was just about 70. He was fun, but he was stern. He meant business when he wanted to do something. He was the founder of St. Hedwig's Church in 1914. He saw that a convent was built and brought the sisters here in 1928. He saw that St. Joseph's School was built on the church property that same year. In 1947, he made a drive for the hospital. Before the hospital was built, we had $38,000 all raised by volunteers. Yes, he was very instrumental in a lot of things held in Barry's Bay. He'd never ask anybody for anything. If a woman was a widow, he would say, "I don't want anything. If you can't give to the collection in church, you don't have to." He never begged people for money, but they always used to come forward and say, "We're going to give." He was made a Monsignor in 1946. The church burned the mortgage before he passed away. Last year was the 75th anniversary of St. Hedwig's. the Sacred Heart League brought a plaque in memory of Monsignor Bernacchi and in memory of the late Monsignor Micah, who took over as parish priest after my uncle. And if you ever go in the hospital, you see a huge picture that says that he was the founder of the hospital. Even on his big tombstone, it says the founder of the hospital and the church and the schools and everything. He was really great. The younger people wouldn't remember, but the older ones, he really touched them very much. After Monsignor Micah passed away, we got another local priest, Monsignor Ambrose Pick. He has been our parish priest since 1975. We have many priests ordained from our parish, and we're proud of them. My dad started the Island Dairy in 1938. I was away up north and they called me home. Dad says, "You get home because I'm starting." This is his announcement from February 1938. "I wish to announce to the people of Barry's Bay and vicinity the opening of my new pasteurized plant, fully equipped with the latest mechanism to ensure a perfect product. I solicit your patronage and promise in return a dairy service which will meet with your satisfaction." He bought the land from Jack Conway, and he started the building. It was right where the dairy is today. He bought all new machinery from De Laval. We didn't have a restaurant, but we sold milk off the counter and cream and ice cream. Dad started in 1938. We had a wood-fired furnace and a boiler. I recall we had a hole dug for a well, and we went home and put a lantern in by the hole to keep it warm so that nothing would freeze. When we got back next morning, the lantern had smoked, and the dairy was all black. We just painted the walls, and we had to get up there and scrub and paint it again. Oh, my sister and I were crying. But anyway, we all worked as a family to get things back to order. The milk was all from our father's dairy herd, our own milk. He used to run 25 or 30 Holstein cows. He had a registered Holstein herd for our dairy, and then he had a few Jerseys that give richer milk. The government came in and said we couldn't sell any raw milk. It would all have to be pasteurized, so he tackled it. We had to get the milk and pasteurize it and bottle it and deliver it from house to house. We had a boiler that had to be fired to pasteurize the milk and sterilize the bottles. We had to have steam for that. Our next-door neighbor looked after the fire at nights. Then, when we came in, we'd have to sterilize all the bottles and bottle the milk. We really went through something. For deliveries, we had a horse called Barney. One time, my brother was delivering milk when it got dark. There were no lights like there are today. He came to St. Joseph's Convent, and he said, "Barney, get going." First thing you knew, he and the cart and the horse were in a big hole. They had opened a cesspool. They were going to dig it out and clean it. What a mess! Oh, he said he'd never forget that. He thought it was funny, but I didn't think it was so funny. We had quite a lot of experiences. In the winter, the milk went to town over the ice, but in the summer, the milk would have to go over that floating bridge. One day, my brother was loading in the cans of milk to go from the farm to the dairy to pasteurize. He told my sister to get in for a minute, and then he closed the door and he galloped right over the floating bridge. She screamed for help. She said, "We'll be drowned." He got her to Main Street and let her out right there. She was so embarrassed because there were people on the street. She had on an old pair of rubber boots and the whole thing. We never charged for the glass bottles when we delivered the milk, but lately I found one of our bottles at a flea market in Toronto. I was very happy to have one with our dairy name on it, but it took me quite a bit of money to pick it up. My brother stayed on the farm. Some of the rest of the brothers and sisters went out away to work, but I stayed too and helped my mother. Somebody had to stay. I was almost 30 years old when I went off this farm, but I worked here until then, and I still worked after, and I'm still yet helping out if I can. I held on to my land. Dad would say, "Please don't ever sell it before I close my eyes." I says, "Well, okay, I'll pay the taxes and use it, and it'll be good." I have my own garden and everything. I like to have my roots. I want to hold this place. Here, my children have a home. I want them to carry on like I did, and like my dad always said. We were always taught this way, home and church. Before you get out further, it's nice to belong to so many organizations, but I'd like to see that the home and the church is done first.
That was Leslie Betts reading the words of Teresa Beanish, born Teresa Mask, on the same day her father purchased Masked Island, 1917. Teresa died just before Christmas, 2002, at 85 years of age. Finally, we have our last but certainly not our least story. Known far and wide through most of the 20th century as Mary Cebulski or Mrs. Frank F. Cebulski, she was born in 1906 as Mary O'Manick. And talk about a role model for any aspiring young girl wanting to make her mark in the world. Here's Kathy Chepesky with the words of Mary Cebulski.
My father's name was John O'Manick, Jan in Polish. It should be O'Mernick, O-M-E-R-N-I-K. That's the way it is out in the cemetery, and that's what my birth certificate says. That's the right way. But they changed it when Dad went into the mill with Murray's. They changed it to O'Manick. My father was born in Poland in 1874, and he got lost coming across the ocean. He was put on a different ship, and the ship went to the United States instead of to Canada. His mother and stepfather came a year ahead of him. They didn't have enough money to bring him across with them. He came with a cousin of his a year later. The cousin was 17. Someone in England got the ships mixed up, and he ended up on the American ship and landed at Buffalo instead of Quebec. His mother didn't know. She thought he was drowned because he never got here. He didn't land in Canada, so she figured he was drowned, so she didn't do anything. So he was 8 years old when he ended up in the States in 1882, and he couldn't speak English. Well, a man named Hewitt from Niagara Falls was looking for some help. He went down to Buffalo to get the men who were coming across to work on the farms, but when the ship came in, there was no men, just the two boys. An elderly lady wanted somebody to help her, so she took the older boy. Hewitt, the man that took Dad, had four sons, and the oldest one was the age of Dad, so Hewitt figured, oh well, I have clothes I can give him to help him out, so he took Dad. Dad stayed with them for a number of years until he could find out where his mother was. He knew he had a mother in Canada, but he didn't know where she was. Then, in 1898, he came to Canada, and his cousin was with him. They went to Renfrew, and somebody there told them to go to Wilno. When they got to Wilno, somebody knew my grandmother and sent him up here. I guess she got an awful shock when she saw him. He stayed here for 2 months, and then he had to go back to the Hewitts. They had just let him come to see his mother. He stayed there 4 more years, and then he came back to Canada and stayed. And in 1902, he got married to Elizabeth Gutowski. He was 28. They had 2 children, Joseph and Mary, living. He was 8 when he came over, and he went to the States. He was 21 when he met the rest of the family, 4 half-sisters and 3 half-brothers. I guess he always felt, being away from the family so long, that he was kind of by himself. Imagine him being picked up by a man and he couldn't speak English. He had to wait until he learned how to talk the language before he could ask for his mother. He went through quite a lot. But he got an education there, and he wouldn't have got it here, because there was no school anywhere near where they lived. They were away out in Siberia. There was no school anywhere out there. Down there he got a few years, anyway. Enough that he could read and write and figure things out. He figured everything out in his head anyway. He could do that quicker than I could on paper. Yes, he was quite clever. So he started a mill out in Pog Lake with Martin Palbeski. They had a mill for a while, and then he went in with John Sierra. He was with him for a few years, and then the Murrays in the Murray and O'Manick Lumber Company. And that's when they had the mill down here, and the camps. Mick Murray used to mostly look after the camps, and Tom Murray looked after the books. My dad looked after anything that broke, the trucks and the sleighs and all. That was his work. He watched all that. Then, in the summer, if anything broke in the mill, he fixed it, or took it to Ottawa and had it fixed. He looked after that part of it. My father worked very hard. He liked to keep things going. He wanted to make things as good as he could for the town. He worked hard for the town, because his roots were here. He wasn't raised here, but his mother was here. I used to go down in the boat with my father to take supplies to the men who were bringing the logs up to the mill. I always went down with him to Cumbermere, Palm Rapids, then up Kaministiquia Lake and then to the bay. There were men cutting logs down around Palm Rapids and Cumbermere, and their logs were all brought up here by water. I went with the Mrs. Murrays, Mrs. Mick Murray and Mrs. Tom Murray. We went out to one of the camps. I was about 14, I guess, and the cooks fed us really well. We watched the men cutting logs and hauling them out to the lake. Tom Bonna was a cook that used to be in the camps. That Tom Bonna, did he ever joke? He was quite a man. He was good to me, though, every time I went to the camps. All the cooks were good to me. They used to give me cookies and pie and all kinds of things. My grandmother used to come and stay with us. Dad's mother, my grandmother, used to come out for the winter and stay with us so she could go to church, and she would help me do the chores. She always thought I worked too hard. Oh, we were a great pair. I went places with her. If she wanted to go somewhere, I went with her. She used to tell stories about the old days in Poland. Another elderly lady used to come to stay at our place for Christmas and Easter, and they would talk and I would listen, but I've forgotten a lot of it. They had a hard life. It was quite interesting. My grandmother helped to work the first picnic that we had. She and my mother and another elderly lady and Tom Bonna, that cook that used to be in the camps, and the other men and women in the parish. There was a lot of different people who helped out. All the men who worked around here, they all helped when the church was built, and the hospital. We had picnics and bazaars to raise money to build the church and hospital. My father used to sing in the concerts, and he helped a lot with the church when they were building it in 1914. I used to collect for the picnics and bazaars. We had to go to every house to collect. People would give food and different things. Some of them made towels and aprons and different things like that. The bazaars were in the hall of the church, and all the baking for the picnics was done right back at the church, and it was all kept in the basement of the church, all the pies and cookies. And from year to year, they've just got doing more all the time. Some of the women made the pies, some of them made the filling. Some of the men did the meat, and some of the women would peel the potatoes. When there were just a few people, everybody worked together more. Now there are lots of different people in the town. There are many here now that I don't know at all. At first, it was Murray and O'Manick. Then it changed to Dad and my brother and myself and Horace Landon. It was called Barry's Bay Lumber Company Limited. I was the secretary. Well, I worked in the office for 10 years, and then when I was married, I helped my husband out. We had 2 children, Norbert and Francis. He had the garage uptown, so I did the books there. And then we had a mill also, in 1945, and I also ran the light company. Frank passed away when he was 48, so I looked after the business from then on. My dad had electricity that he ran from the mill. They had engines at the mill that ran the lights. When they moved the mill to Canoe Lake, I took over the lights and we ran them from the garage. We had 2 big engines there. Electricity made a big difference to the town. It helped the town out a lot. Well, then the town bought the electricity, and they ran it from the mill on the bay when it was Jack Conway's mill. Dad moved the big mill to Canoe Lake, and Jack Conway built a small mill on the bay, and he ran the lights then for a few years, until they went in with hydro. There is a story about the mill in the newspaper. John O'Manick, Thomas Murray, and Michael Murray started a lumber mill in Barry's Bay in 1908 and a planing mill in 1920 called Murray and O'Manick Lumber Company. In 1910, John O'Manick built the first rink in Barry's Bay. That was just below where the other rink is now. The lumber yard went from the rink to where the high school is. John O'Manick built the first rink in Barry's Bay, and in 1927 he started putting the first electric lights in the village. The power came from a plant at the mill. In 1930, O'Manick took over the mill and enlarged it. It was called the Barry's Bay Lumber Company Limited, and to form it, he brought in his son Joseph and daughter Mary, along with Horace Landon. In 1942, the mill was moved to Canoe Lake, and the planing mill was sold to John P. Conway. At that time, the light plant was taken over by his daughter, Mary Cebulski. It was operated by her husband, Frank F. Cebulski, at his garage for about 3 years. The plant was then sold to the village. Frank Cebulski built his garage and service station in 1926, and later added on a store from which he sold plumbing and electrical equipment, boats and motors, and some farm equipment. In 1930, Frank Cebulski built the first snowmobile in these parts, and in 1935, he received his pilot's license and owned the first plane in Barry's Bay. He went to Toronto and took up the mechanics craft and came back and built a garage. Then in the winter, he worked out at the camps. He looked after the trucks. There was one truck they had out there that pulled 12 sleighs of logs, and he looked after that. But Frank died at 48. We went through a lot of hard times. The First World War was hard, and then the Depression, the 1930s, that was harder. We had to really work then to keep things going because we didn't get anything much for what we were selling. We would get $10 a thousand for lumber, up to about $50 for the best lumber. We tried a lot of different businesses to try to keep going. We had to. We had to do something to keep living and to help each other out. We had about 400 men working because they had day and night shift for a while. Dad was in on the start of tourism up here. When Americans came from the States, Dad took the lumber down for them and helped them to build their cottages. So you might say my dad was in on the start of tourism up here. When they came in the summertime, I would meet them at the train and bring them down to the lake. Dad would take them down to their cottages because there was no road for them to come in. They had to go by boat. My father lived in Ottawa for a while. A few years after my mother passed away, my father married a girl from Ottawa. They had one son, John. When Dad was older and was ill, he came to the hospital here until he passed away at 89.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading the words of Mary Cebulski as dictated by herself back in 1991, a few years before she died in her 91st year in 1997. We hope you enjoyed this year's crop of our best lilies of the valley, and that you understand why these three lives were not lived in vain. Their spirit lives on in many ways. One has to spend only a little time thinking about those 146 babies Helen helped to bring into this world, or Teresa's contribution to the success of the Island Dairy, or Mary's effort to literally keep the lights on in town during the Depression and long into the Second World War. I'm Carol Peterson, and for Leslie Betts, Kathy Chepesky, Kristen Marchand, and our producer Barry Conway, we'd like to wish you a good day and God bless.